Chapter 2. Seville, California has a good public library. But the best thing about living in Seville is that in only a 20-minute drive, you're over into Santa Cruz where the beach is and the amusement park is. And it's four lanes all the way. To me, though, the library has been important in forming my education and convictions. On Fridays, which is my day off, I go down around 10 in the morning and read Life and the cartoons in the Saturday Evening Post. And then, if the librarians aren't watching me, I get the photography magazines from the rack and read them over for the purpose of finding those special art poses that they have the girls doing. And if you look carefully in the front and back of the photography magazines, you find ads that nobody else notices. Ads there for you. But you need to be familiar with the wording. Anyhow, what those ads get you, if you send in the dollar, is something different from what you see even in the best magazines, like Playboy or Esquire. You get photos of girls doing something else entirely, and in some ways they're better, although usually the girls are older, sometimes even baggy old hags, and they're never pretty, and worst of all, they have big, fat, saggy breasts. But they are doing really unusual things. Things that you'd never ordinarily expect to see girls do in pictures. Not especially dirty things, because after all, these come through the federal mails from Los Angeles and Glendale. But things such as one I remember, in which one girl was lying down on the floor, wearing a black lace bra and black stockings and French heels. And this other girl was mopping her all over with a mop from a bucket of suds. That held my attention for months. And then there was another I remember of a girl wearing the usual, as above, pushing another girl similarly attired down a ladder, so that the victim girl, if that's what you call it, at least that's how I usually think of it, was all bent and lopsided, as if her arms and legs were broken, like a rag doll or something, as if she's been run over. And then always there's the ones you get in which the stronger girl, the master, has the other tied up. Bondage pictures, they're called. And better than that are the bondage drawings. They're really competent artists who draw those. Some are really worth seeing. Others, in fact, most of them are the run-of-the-mill junk and really shouldn't be allowed to go through the mails. They're so crude. For years, I've had a strange feeling looking at these pictures. Not a dirty feeling. Nothing to do with sexuality or relations, but the same feeling you get when you're high up on a mountain, breathing that pure air, the way it is over by Big Basin Park where the redwoods are, and the mountain streams. We used to go hunting around in those redwoods, even though naturally it's illegal to hunt in a state or federal park. We'd get a couple of deer now and then. The guns we used weren't mine, though. I borrowed the one I used from Harvey St. James. Usually, when there's anything worth doing, all three of us, myself and St. James and Bob Paddleford, do it together, using St. James' 57 Ford convertible with the double pipes and twin spots and dropped rear end. It's quite a car, known all around Seville and Santa Cruz. It's gold-colored, that baked-on enamel with purple trim that we did by hand. And we used molded fiberglass to get those sleek lines. It looks more like a rocket ship than a car. It has that look of outer space and velocities nearing the speed of light. For a really big time, where we go is across the Sierras to Reno. We leave late Friday, when St. James gets off from his job selling suits at Habsburg's Menswear. Shoot over to San Jose and pick up Paddleford. He works for Shell Oil, down in the blueprint department. And then we're off to Reno. We don't sleep Friday night at all. We get up there late and go right to work playing the slots or blackjack. Then around 10 o'clock Saturday morning, we take a snooze in the car, find a washroom to shave and change our shirts and ties, and then we're off looking for women. You can always find that kind of women around Reno. It's really a filthy town. I actually don't enjoy that part too much. It plays no role in my life any more than any other physical activity. Even to look at me, you'd recognize that my main energies are in the mind. When I was in the sixth grade, I started wearing glasses because I read so many funny books. Tip Top Comics and King Comics and Popular Comics. Those were the first comic books to appear, back in the mid-30s. And then there were a whole lot more. I read them all in grammar school and traded them around with other kids. Later on, in junior high, I started reading Astonishing Stories, which was a pseudoscience magazine, and Amazing Stories and Thrilling Wonder. In fact, I had an almost complete file of Thrilling Wonder, which was my favorite. It was from an ad in Thrilling that I got the lucky lodestone that I still carry around with me. That was back around 1939. All my family have been thin, my mother excepted, and as soon as I put on those silver-framed glasses they always gave to boys in those days, I immediately looked scholarly, like a real bookworm. I had a high forehead anyhow. Then, later in high school, I had dandruff to quite an extent, and this made my hair seem lighter than it actually was. Once in a while, I had a stammer that bothered me, although I found that if I suddenly bent down, as if brushing something from my leg, I could speak the word okay, so I got in the habit of doing that. I had, and still have, an indentation on my cheek by my nose, left over from having had the chicken pox. In high school, I felt nervous a great deal of the time, and I used to pick at it until it became infected. Also, I had other skin troubles of the acne type, although in my case, the spots got a purple texture that the dermatologist said was due to some low-grade infection throughout my body. As a matter of fact, although I'm 34, I still break out in boils once in a while. Not on my face, but on my butt or armpits. In high school, I had some nice clothes, and that made it possible for me to step out and be popular. In particular, I had one blue cashmere sweater that I wore for almost 4 years, until it got to smelling so bad the gym instructor made me throw it away. He had it in for me anyhow, because I never took a shower in gym. It was from the American Weekly, not from any magazines, that I got my interest in science. Possibly you remember the article they had in the May 4th, 1935 issue on the Sargasso Sea? At that time, I was 10 years old and in the high fourth, so I was just barely old enough to read something besides funny books. There was a huge drawing in 6 or 7 colors that covered 2 whole opened-up pages. It showed ships stuck in the Sargasso Sea that had been there for hundreds of years. It showed the skeletons of the sailors covered with seaweed, the rotting sails and masts of the ships, and all different kinds of ships, even some ancient Greek and Roman ones, and some from the time of Columbus, and then the Norsemen's ships, jumbled in together, never stirring, stuck there forever, trapped by the Sargasso Sea. The article told how ships got drawn in and trapped, and how no one ever got away. There were so many that they were side by side for miles. Every kind of ship that existed, although later on when there were steamships, fewer ships got stuck, obviously because they didn't depend on wind currents but had their own power. The article affected me because in many ways it reminded me of an episode on Jack Armstrong, the All-American Boy, that had seemed very important to me, having to do with the Elephant's Lost Graveyard. I remember that Jack had a metal key that, when struck, resonated strangely and was the key to the graveyard. For a long time, I knocked every bit of metal I came across against something to make it resonate, trying to produce that sound and find the Elephant's Lost Graveyard on my own. A door was supposed to open in the rock somewhere. When I read the article on the Sargasso Sea, I saw an important resemblance. The Elephant's Lost Graveyard was sought for because of all the ivory, and in the Sargasso Sea, there was millions of dollars worth of jewels and gold, the cargoes of the trapped ships, just waiting to be located and claimed. And the difference between the two was that the Elephant's Lost Graveyard wasn't a scientific fact, but just a myth brought back by fever-crazed explorers and natives, whereas the Sargasso Sea was scientifically established. On the floor of our living room, in the house we rented back in those days on Illinois Avenue, I had the article spread out, and when my sister came home with my mother and father, I tried to interest her in it. But at that time, she was only 8. We got into a terrible fight about it, and the upshot was that my father grabbed up the American Weekly and threw it into the paper bag of refuse under the sink. That upset me so badly that I had a fantasy about him dealing with the Sargasso Sea. It was so disgusting that even now I can't bear to think about it. That was one of the worst days in my life, and I always held it against Faye, my sister, that she was responsible for what happened. If she had read the article and listened to me talk about it as I wanted her to, nothing would have gone wrong. It really got me down that something so important, and in a sense beautiful, should be degraded the way it was that day. It was as if a delicate dream was trampled on and destroyed. Neither my father nor mother were interested in science. My father worked with another man, an Italian, as a carpenter and house painter, and for a number of years he was with the Southern Pacific Railroad in the maintenance department at the Gilroy Yards. He never read anything himself except the San Francisco Examiner and Reader's Digest and the National Geographic. My mother subscribed to Liberty, and then when that went out of business, she read Good Housekeeping. Neither of them had any education, scientific or otherwise. They always discouraged me and Faye from reading, and off and on during my childhood they raided my rooms and burned everything in the way of reading material they could get their hands on, even library books. During World War II, when I was in the service and overseas fighting on Okinawa, they went into my room at home, the room that had always belonged to me, gathered up all my science fiction magazines and scrapbooks of girl pictures, and even my Oz books and popular science magazines, and burned them, just as they had done when I was a child. When I got back from defending them against the enemy, I found that there was nothing to read in the whole house, and all my valuable reference files of unusual scientific facts were gone forever. I do remember, though, what was probably the most startling fact from that file of thousands. Sunlight has weight. Every year the Earth weighs 10,000 pounds more because of the sunlight that reaches it from the sun. That fact has never left my mind. And the other day, I calculated that since I first learned the fact in 1940, almost 1,900,000 pounds of sunlight have fallen on the Earth. And then, too, a fact that is becoming more and more known to intelligent persons. An application of mind power can move an object at a distance. This is something I've known all along, because as a child I used to do it. In fact, my whole family did it, even my father. It was a regular activity that we engaged in, especially when out in public places such as restaurants. One time, we all concentrated on a man wearing a gray suit and got him to reach his right hand back and scratch his neck. Another time, in a bus, we influenced a big old colored woman to get to her feet and get off the bus, although that took some doing, probably because she was so heavy. This was spoiled one day, however, by my sister, who, when we were concentrating on a man across the waiting room from us, suddenly said, "What a lot of crap." Both my mother and father were furious at her, and my father gave her a shaking. Not so much for using a word like that at her age. She was about 11. But for interrupting our mind concentration. I guess she picked up the word from some of the boys at Millard Fillmore Grammar School, where she was in the 5th grade at that time. Even that young, she had started getting rough and tough. She liked to play kickball and baseball, and she was always down on the boys' playground instead of with the girls. Like me, she has always been thin. She used to be able to run very well, almost like a professional athlete. And she used to grab something like, say, my weekly package of jujubes that I always bought on Saturday morning with my allowance, and ran off somewhere and ate it. She has never gotten much of a figure, even now that she's more than 30 years old. But she has nice long legs and a springy walk, and 2 times a week she goes to a modern dance class and does exercises. She weighs about 116 pounds. Because of being a tomboy, she always used men's words. And when she got married the first time, she married a man who made his living as owner of a little factory that makes metal signs and gates. Until his heart attack, he was a pretty rough guy. The two of them used to go climbing up and down the cliffs out at Point Reyes, up where they live in Marin County, and for a time they had two Arabian horses that they rode. Strangely, he had his heart attack playing badminton, a child's game. The birdie got hit over his head by Faye, and he ran backward, tripped over a gopher hole, and fell over on his back. Then he got up, cursed a blue streak when he saw that his racket had snapped in half, started into the house for another racket, and had his heart attack coming back outdoors again. Of course, he and Faye had been quarreling a lot as usual, and that may have had something to do with it. When he got mad, he had no control over the language he used, and Faye has always been the same way, not merely using gutter words, but in the indiscriminate choice of insults, harping on each other's weak points and saying anything that might hurt, whether true or not. In other words, saying anything, and very loud, so that their two children got quite an earful. Even in his normal conversation, Charlie had always been foul-mouthed, which is something you might expect from a man who grew up in a town in Colorado. Faye always enjoyed his language. The two of them made quite a pair. I remember one day when the three of us were out on their patio enjoying the sun, when I happened to say something I think having to do with space travel, and Charlie said to me, "Isidore, you sure are a crap artist." Faye laughed, because it made me so sore. It made no difference to her that I was her brother. She didn't care who Charlie insulted. The irony of a slob like that, a paunchy, beer-drinking, ignorant Midwesterner who never got through high school, calling me a crap artist, lingered in my mind and caused me to select the ironic title that I have on this work. I can just see all the Charlie Humes in the world, with their portable radios tuned to the Giants' ball games, a big cigar sticking out of their mouths, that slack, vacant expression on their fat red faces. And it's slobs like that who are running this country and its major businesses and its army and navy, in fact, everything. It's a perpetual mystery to me. Charlie only employed 7 guys at his ironworks, but think of that. 7 human beings dependent on a farmer like that for their very livelihood. A man like that in a position to blow his nose on the rest of us, on anybody who has sensitivity or talent. Their house, up in Marin County, cost them a lot of money because they built it themselves. They bought 10 acres of land back in 1951 when they first got married, and then, while they were living in Petaluma, where Charlie's factory is, they hired an architect and got their plans drawn up for their house. In my opinion, Faye's whole motive for getting mixed up with a man like that in the first place was to finally wind up with a house such as she did wind up with. After all, when he met her, he already owned his factory and netted a good $40,000 a year, at least to hear him tell it. Our family had never had any money. We ate off a set of dime store Blue Willow for 10 years, and I don't think my father ever owned a new suit at any time in his life. Of course, by winning a scholarship and being able to go on to college, Faye started meeting men from good homes, the frat boys who always horse around with big-game bonfires and the like. For a year or so, she went steady with a boy studying to be a law student, a fairy-like creature who never did appeal much to me, although he liked to play pinball machines, to learn the mathematical odds, as he explained it. Charlie met her by chance, in a roadside grocery store on Highway 1 near Fort Ross. She was ahead of him in line, buying hamburger buns and Coca-Cola and cigarettes, and humming a Mozart tune which she had learned in a college music course. Charlie thought it was an old hymn that he had sung back in Cannon City, Colorado, and he started talking to her. Outside the grocery store, he had his Mercedes-Benz car parked, and she could see it, with that 3-point star sticking up from the radiator. Naturally, Charlie had on his Mercedes-Benz pin sticking out of his shirt, so she and the rest of the world could see whose car it was. And she had always wanted a good car, especially a foreign one. As I constructed, based on my fairly thorough knowledge of both of them, the conversation went like this. "Is that car out there a 6 or an 8? Faye asked him.
"A 6,"
Charlie said. Good God, Faye said. Only a six. Even the Rolls-Royce is a six, Charlie said. Those Europeans don't make eights. What do you need eight cylinders for? Good God, the Rolls-Royce a six. All her life, Faye had wanted to ride in a Rolls-Royce. She had seen one once, parked at the curb by a fancy restaurant in San Francisco. The three of us, she and I and Charlie, walked all around it. That's a terrific car, Charlie said, and proceeded to give us details on how it worked. I couldn't have cared less. If I had my choice, I'd like a Thunderbird or a Corvette. Faye listened to him and we walked on, and I could see that she wasn't too interested either. Something had distressed her. They're so flashy-looking, she said. I always thought of a Rolls as a classic-looking car, like a World War I military sedan, an officer's car. Consider to yourself if you've never actually seen a new Rolls. They're small, metallic, streamlined but also chunky, heavy-looking, like some of the Jaguar saloon models, only more impressive. British streamlining, if you get the picture. Personally, I wouldn't have one on a bet, and I could see that Faye was wrestling with the same reaction. This one had a silver-blue finish with lots of chrome. In fact, the whole car had a polished look, and this appealed to Charlie, who liked metal and not wood or plastic. There's a real car, he said. Obviously, he could see that he wasn't getting across to either of us. All he could do was repeat himself in his customary clumsy way. Beside his gutter words, he had the vocabulary of a six-year-old. Just a few words to cover everything. That's a car, he said finally, as we got to the house we had come to San Francisco to visit. But it would look out of place in Petaluma. Especially parked in the lot at your plant, I said. Faye said, what a waste it would be, putting all that money into a car. $12,000. Hell, I could pick one up for a lot less, Charlie said. I know the guy who runs the British Motor Car Agency down here. No doubt he wanted the car, and left to himself, he possibly would have bought it. But their money had to go into their house, whether Charlie liked it or not. Faye wouldn't let him buy any more cars. He had owned, besides the Mercedes, a Triumph and a Studebaker Golden Hawk, and, of course, several trucks for the business. Faye had told the architect to put radiant heating into the house, the resistance wire type, and up in the country where they were it would cost them a fortune in electricity. Everyone else up there uses butane or burns wood. On the cow pasture, Faye was having a swanky modern San Francisco type of house built, with recessed bathtubs, plenty of tile and mahogany paneling, fluorescent lighting, custom kitchen, electric washer and dryer combination. The works, including a custom hi-fi combination with speakers built right into the walls. The house had a glass side looking out onto the acres and a fireplace in the center of the living room, a circular barbecue type with a huge black chimney stuck over it. Naturally, the floor had to be asphalt tile in case logs rolled out. Faye had four bedrooms built, plus a study that could be used by guests. Three bathrooms in all, one for the children, one for the guests, one for herself and Charlie. And a sewing room, a utility room, a family room, dining room, even a room for the freezer. And of course, a TV room. The whole house rested on a concrete slab. That and the asphalt tile made it so cold that the radiant heating could never be shut off, except in the hottest part of summer. If you shut it off when you went to bed, by morning the house was like a cold storage unit. After it had been built, and Charlie and Faye and the two children had moved into it, they discovered that even with the fireplace and radiant heating, the house was cold from October through April, and that during the wet season the water failed to drain off the soil, and instead seeped into the house around the frames holding the glass and under the doors. For 2 months in 1955, the house sat in a pool of water. A contractor had to come out and build a whole new drainage system to carry water away from the house. And in 1956, They put 220-volt wall heaters with manual switches and thermostats, both, into every room of the house. The damp and cold had begun to mildew all the clothes and the sheets on the bed. They also found that in winter, the electric power was interrupted for several days on end, and during that time they could not cook on the electric stove, and the pump that pumped their water, being electric, failed to pump. The water heater was electric too, so that everything had to be cooked and heated over the fireplace. Fay even had to wash clothes in a zinc bucket propped up in the fireplace. And all four of them got the flu every winter that they lived up there. They had three separate heating systems, and yet the house remained drafty. For instance, the long hall between the children's rooms and the front part of the house had no heat at all, and when the kids came scampering out in their pajamas at night, they had to go from their warm rooms into the cold, and then back into the heat of the living room again. And they did that every night at least six times. Worse than anything else, Fay could never find a babysitter up there in the country, and the consequence was that gradually she and Charlie stopped visiting people. People had to visit them, and it took an hour and a half of difficult driving to get up there to Drake's Landing from San Francisco. And yet they loved the house. They had four black-faced sheep cropping grass outside their glass side, their Arabian horses, a collie dog as large as a pony that won prizes, and some of the most beautiful imported ducks in the world. During the time that I lived up there with them, I enjoyed some of the most interesting moments of my life.